Morning, everyone. So I'm here at UC Santa Barbara in the chemical engineering and materials departments. I think my talk's going to be probably quite different than many of you. Most people talk about coarse graining in the context of statistical mechanics in terms of particle models, and I'm going to be talking about statistical field theories as the basis. And so I want to tell you a little bit about where we are in this research program. I want to put the acknowledgments up front. I've been very fortunate to work with a very talented group of postdocs and graduate students. Just some of them are listed here in this program. I'll be particularly talking about Mike Vallee's thesis work today. He's going to be defending this summer. Hopefully he'll get some of these papers written, so much of what I'm talking about actually is not published at this point. Perhaps also somewhat unusual for a theory group, a lot of this work's actually been funded by a consortium of companies. In that work, we've been pursuing a wide variety of applications. I'm not going to talk about those today. This talk is really going to talk about the methodology of these simulations and kind of where we are in coarse graining. The general motivation for this work has to do with designing soft material formulations that involve polymers. Polymers are kind of ubiquitous in many, many applications, but I've given a few examples here. Think about things like personal care products, paints, coatings, adhesives, things that are formulated in solution, maybe water, maybe an organic medium. Plastic materials. And then you start thinking about higher tech kinds of things, materials related to energy devices, materials related to display technologies, materials related to fabricating microelectronic devices on ever finer scales. So many of this involve formulated polymer systems. And there's a lot of interest in trying to nanostructure or mesostructure, and here I'm defining nano to meso in kind of the 1 nanometer to 1 micron kind of length scale, about 3 orders of magnitude. And the reason for doing that is that by nanostructuring polymer formulations, you can get combinations of properties that you can't get without doing that. Kind of typical example of how you nanostructure a polymer formulation is a block copolymer. So you hook chemically incompatible polymers together by covalent bonds or other kind of bonding techniques. And you get a material that intrinsically wants to phase separate it, but is it limited in its ability to do it? And so what you get is a so-called microphase separation, even though it typically occurs with features and feature spacings with about a 10 nanometer length scale. And you see, this is a real TEM micrograph of a styrene isoprene, styrene tri-block copolymer that has cylinders of polystyrene packed on a beautiful hexagonal lattice. And that's the lowest free energy configuration. So in my talk today, I want to talk about the field theory framework that we're using in this area. And you'll see that after we've introduced these field theories, we have a couple of ways of computing with them. We can compute at the mean field level, which in some sense is a well-known theory called self-consistent field theory, but we have new and better ways to find these mean field solutions. Or we have a kind of no approximation direct attack on the field theory. We call that field theoretic simulations. And I'll spend probably about half the talk talking about our recent work on coarse graining by force matching. So why might you want to do simulations this way with statistical field theories as opposed to particle-based models? So if you're in this kind of nano to meso scale, which I'll define here as kind of nanometers to microns, you're challenged, particularly as you go up towards the high end of that scale, in doing fully atomistic simulations. And particularly if you're talking about systems like molten polymers of high molecular weight that are entangled can have stress relaxation times that are seconds or longer. As you get towards a glass transition, kind of arbitrarily large. You get challenged both spatially and temporally in trying to simulate these types of systems. And even with coarse-grained models, coarse-grained particle-based models, it's perhaps not obvious, but it turns out that statistical field theories of the sort that I'm going to be talking about actually have a kind of perverse character to them. They actually get easier as you go denser and you go higher in molecular weight. And the reason for that, as we'll see, is that the fields actually fluctuate more weakly as you go to the high density limit. The other thing is because you're obviously working with a theory based on fields, systematic coarse graining is a bit more natural. It's actually closely connected to numerical renormalization group theory, at least Wilson-style renormalization group theory. And there's also potentially the benefit to kind of more seamlessly connect to continuum mechanics, which is also field-based. I want to talk to you a little bit about how you build these field theory models. So our starting point is actually not a field theory, but it's a particle-based model, but a coarse-grained one. We can build these models for wide varieties of types of fluids and various polymer components. The polymers we tend to use continuous thread-like Gaussian chains. They're cheaper to compute with. In principle, though, you can substitute other chain models, worm-like chains with a penalty for bending, bead spring models, different kinds of models of that sort. In terms of through-space interactions between segments on the polymer, we tend to use simple contact types of interactions. So in solution, the contact strength is typically referred to as an excluded volume parameter. It's a measure of the potential mean force of repulsion between segments in a solvent. In the melt context, we usually refer to those contact parameters as Flory-Chi parameters. We can easily deal with electrostatic interactions, long-range interactions. In the case of a melt, we tend not to put harsh repulsive interactions in the model. Instead, we'll introduce an incompressibility constraint on the total density field for all the components. And we can deal with essentially polymers of arbitrary complexity in these models. So how do you go from the particle model to the field theory? I should point out this is really a formalism at this point for equilibrium statistical mechanics. It's not a non-equilibrium framework, although we can talk a bit at the end about how you might go in that direction. So what we really want to do is take a partition function in some ensemble, for example, NVT, originally posed as a high-dimensional integral over particle positions, which in this context means shapes of polymers and positions of polymers, and then transform it into a statistical field theory where we're doing functional integrals over one or more fields, auxiliary fields, and the fields are introduced to decouple these interactions that we put in our coarse-grained particle model. Okay, I mean, the methods for doing this are fairly standard in the literature. For example, go under the name of Hubbard-Stratonovich transformations. They're basically based on Gaussian integral identities. So for example, if we take a pairwise repulsive interaction model, you can write the potential energy as basically a Gaussian in the microscopic density of polymer segments. So that's rho hat. And V here would be the pair potential. This Gaussian can be re-expressed in terms of that Gaussian integral where we've introduced an auxiliary field W. And I want to point out a couple of features of this. Inside the integrand in this Gaussian, we've got the inverse of the potential instead of the potential. Here I've looked at the case where V is purely repulsive. It turns out you need an I factor in the linear term to get the sign right. What that means is the field that's been introduced is pure imaginary, okay? And at the end of the day, you end up then with an action or effective Hamiltonian that's complex valued, not real valued, if you want to play this game. An attractive interaction can be decoupled with a real field, but any reasonable model of a fluid has attractive and repulsive interactions. So in general, you end up with a complex valued effective Hamiltonian. Okay, so, and this comes, the fact that, you know, this Boltzmann weight ultimately is a complex number has implications for how we sample these field theories. Okay, so this is an example of a model that you get by doing this step. This is actually a classic model, was looked at by Sam Edwards in the 1960s. He was using this type of a polymer field theory formalism to look at things like excluded volume effects, excluded volume screening, and semi-dilute polymer solutions. I think he never imagined that this would be a formalism for doing computer simulations, but it was certainly a formalism that was convenient for doing a variety of approximate analytical types of calculations. So this is a simple model. We've got homopolymers in an implicit solvent with a repulsive contact interaction, vis this excluded volume parameter. You go through the steps, you get a partition function as written as an integral over one field, W. The potential is inverted, so there's a 1 over V in the quadratic term. And the polymers are now decoupled, so in an NVT ensemble, I have N factors of the log of the partition function of a single polymer experiencing now this purely imaginary field, IW. Okay, so this object actually carries all the non-locality and the non-quadratic nature of the field theory. It's a complicated functional Q. How do we evaluate that? We evaluate it deterministically. Essentially, we have to do a path integral over a polymer that's sitting in this, in a particular configuration of this purely imaginary field. So we write, basically, analogous to a Schrodinger equation, we write a diffusion equation for a chain end propagator. So Q of R of S is the statistical weight of the end of a polymer of contour length S that's sitting at position R. This is basically just the first terms here is a free diffusion, which would generate a random walk. But we have to do a random walk in the presence of an imaginary potential. And we have an initial condition on the contour that a polymer of zero length can't feel the field and is uniformly distributed. So this is basically a deterministic scheme for given a value of the field, W, calculating this propagator, so propagated all the way to the end of the chain, one more quadrature then gives you the partition function. So we have a well-defined procedure for taking a field configuration, associating a value of the partition function, and that then allows us to evaluate the action or the energy weight in the field theory. Okay? This turns out to be basically the inner loop and where all the cost is in doing the simulations that we're talking about today. Now, we've introduced these auxiliary fields to basically rewrite our partition function as a statistical field theory. But we obviously need access to various observable quantities. So for example, if you want to know what's the density of polymer segments at some point R, you need some operator that's a functional of the field that you can average over field configurations to compute density. It turns out if you have computed these chain end propagators, you can compute things like the density. So to have density at some point R, you have to have a polymer threaded through there, and so you can compose a propagator from this end and this end to compute the density. Similarly, if you want to know the elastic stress or the pressure in the simulation, you can derive a similar kind of formula with this dyadic between the two propagators. Okay, so that's how you build these field theory models, and you can build them for a wide variety of fluid models. Basically, any classical fluid model, you can do this. How do we compute? So we have a couple of ways. We can make an approximation, an analytical approximation to the field theory. Assume that somewhere in the complex plane is a saddle point field configuration that dominates this integral and approximate this by the leading term in a steepest descent type approximation, where we find those saddle points by this condition. That leads to a well-known mean field theory. So these saddle points are associated with mean field solutions to the model. That's known as self-consistent field theory. You can prove it's actually the leading approximation in the limit where a parameter, I'll call it C, which is basically the number density of polymers made dimensionless with the radius of gyration of a polymer. So physically, that number C is, if you think about a sphere that surrounds a test polymer in your system, it's the average number of other polymers that are penetrating that sphere. So it's a type of effective coordination number. And as you might expect, in the limit that that's very large, which is true for very high molecular weight polymer melts, which are each coil is being penetrated by many other chains, it turns out to be a good approximation. So for melt problems, we like to make that approximation. If we do that, then the free energy, Helmholtz free energy of the system is just the H functional evaluated at the saddle point or mean field configuration. If you can't do that, then you want to fully attack that functional integral by some kind of a stochastic simulation procedure that we call field theoretic simulations. Okay, so let's talk about the mean field case first. How do we find these saddle point solutions? Well, simple way to proceed. Typically, these saddle points are off the real axis in the complex plane. So we do essentially a gradient descent search in the complex plane with some fictitious dynamics. And in terms of numerical algorithms for this, you want good stability. You don't care about accuracy and time because you're just looking for the steady state. The machinery we're using is not kind of typical statistical mechanics machinery because we're working with fields. It's actually a lot more similar to what you'd see people doing turbulence modeling. So we're using, for example, pseudospectral methods. And for bulk problems, we use plane wave bases and parallel FFTs. With this machinery, you can do lots of interesting things. I'll just show you some collage of pictures that involve finding saddle points in different kinds of problems. Pure block copolymers make these spatially periodic mesophases. A reasonable way to proceed is to just try to converge one unit cell of one of these structures in a relatively small cell, but with high resolution. We call those unit cell calculations. If you don't know what's going to form, what kind of self-assembly you're going to have in the system, you might instead take a large cell, many RG on a side with periodic boundary conditions, initialize your fields using a random number generator, and do basically a descent on the mean field energy surface, and see what forms.
Is it 3D or 2D?
This one's 2D. But it's pretty big. It's 1028 plane waves on a side. I put this here because you can see the kind of length scales that we can access in these methods. So this is actually a phase-separated block copolymer here and then droplets of homopolymer coexisting. And we're resolving not only the mesophase, but also the macrophase separation. I'm not going to talk much today about applications, but just give you a flavor for what you can do with some of these things. When you start forming block copolymers from lots of chemically different blocks, in this case, different colors here, the synthetic chemists are getting pretty good at hooking these things together in different ways and putting more and more blocks on the molecule. So for example, you take three block colors, there are three topologically distinct molecules you can make from it. If you add just one more block but still three colors, turns out there are nine of them. And this little table shows you how the numbers kind of explode. So it's a little bit like the field of proteomics where you're trying to relate protein sequence to folded structure to function. Here, what you're interested from a material standpoint is given a given sequence, what's not the intramolecular, but collective assembly of all these molecules into some kind of structure, and then what kind of materials properties might those have? So it's kind of an interesting area. Give you an example of how you can use these tools in this area. And this is a GPU simulation done by Chris Delaney in the group. For a three-color block polymer, polyisoprene, styrene, ethylene oxide, particular composition, particular set of binary interactions, start from a random initial condition to a quench on the energy landscape. And you get this clearly very highly tubular interconnected structure, but with lots of defects. If instead we start from first few plane waves of a space group, it turns out to be the stable structure, you drop very quickly into that stable structure. So you can run these simulations in a kind of discovery mode, start from initial conditions, see what kind of structures you get. We know there are plenty of metastable states, which you can often identify in terms of topological defects, clean those structures up by filtering, and then reconverge a variety of competing structures. Okay, so what happens if mean field theory isn't good enough? In almost any problem that you do in a solvated system, it turns out mean field theory is usually not good enough. So polymer solutions, especially polyelectrolytes or even melt systems in here, order-disorder transitions or critical points. So here we need to somehow sample the full theory, but we're faced with this so-called sign problem, where because H is complex valued, the Boltzmann weight in the field theory is not positive semi-definite, and you basically don't have, you have a kind of complex probability. Basically, Monte Carlo methods are pretty much out. This is a problem that is familiar in lots of different fields, theoretical chemistry, and different branches of theoretical physics. How are we going to deal with this? There's really no general solution, although we found a solution that, at least in our context, seems to work, is basically a sidestep around this sign problem. It's an old theory that was developed by Parisi and Clouder in a couple of papers in the nuclear physics literature back in 1983, and we've adapted it to do these analogous simulations of these complex-valued classical field theories. So the idea is we do a similar fictitious time descent, now in the complex plane, so generalizing the fields off the real axis, analytically continuing to the whole complex plane. But we provide a stochastic kick, but the kick is placed asymmetrically. It's actually just, you just kick the real part of the equations, and it's Gaussian and white with a particular noise strength that's required. So you have essentially not, you know, strictly relaxational equations, but these are stochastic, nonlinear, nonlocal field equations. You can't prove that these field equations have a stationary state, but what you can prove is if they have a steady state, these dynamics sample the proper non-positive weight in the energy functional. Okay? Turns out that you got to have good numerical methods to do this because they are very stiff. So with this methodology, and if you want to see some insights into the types of algorithms that we use, I'm going to have a look at this paper, but I'll just show you what you can do with this kind of thing. So for example, you can look at melting now. So this is a movie where we started with 8-unit cells of a gyroid phase and a block of polymer melt, and then start running one of these complex Langevin simulations, and we're lowering the incompatibility between the blocks. So we go through the melting transition, and we melt this gyroid into a disorder phase. And this is a fluctuation assisted melting, and so you need a fully stochastic sampling procedure to study this. Okay, I'd like to spend the rest of my time talking about coarse graining. And this is work done by Mike Vallée. And this really has to do with how do we get to larger systems? And as a kind of a motivation, imagine you wanted to simulate a system with swollen micelles. We compute, not in the continuum, but on some grid. And we'd like to avoid using a very fine grid spacing, but use a grid spacing that just sort of captures these larger objects that are present from the self-assembly process. But to do that in a quantitative way and describe the energetics of this kind of a phase, we somehow need to go from a fine-grained simulation and then embed smaller scale physics in a renormalized model that we can then compute with on a coarser lattice. So that's the strategy. We need some way of doing this coarse graining. So I'll introduce what we'll refer to as a mapping operator that will basically take field values on a fine lattice and by some recipe, for example, block averaging, like we do with Ising models, Kadanoff transformations and Ising models, go to a coarse configuration that I'll call big W. And basically what we want to do here is we want to match consistently statistical weights of the fine grain theory and the coarse grain theory. And so this kind of an expression then defines an effective Hamiltonian for the coarse variables. And we've got a constraint that the fine grain configurations map to the coarse variables. We're going to take the usual approach of numerical renormalization group theory. We will assume we can parameterize this coarse grained Hamiltonian as a linear superposition of some basis functionals with some coupling coefficients k prime that we tried to obtain in some optimal way. And the way we have chosen to do this, and have had some luck, is to follow this procedure not from the field theory world, but from the particle world of force matching. And we'll hear later this week from, I think, both Will Noyd and Hans Andersen about these techniques, these force matching techniques. But basically, there's a variational procedure for matching some approximation to the coarse force with a mapped fine grain force that you can derive and use that as a procedure. In this case, with our linear coupling ansatz for the Hamiltonian and hence for the force field, when you minimize this, it's basically least squares that gives you a linear set of equations to solve for these coupling parameters. So the important point is you can do one fine-grained simulation, and by calculating correlation functions from that run, you have a linear system to solve to calculate the coupling parameters in the coarse-grained model. It turns out you actually have to do a similar thing for the operators in the field theory. Remember, we're not interested in the fields themselves. These were auxiliary fields, but we're also interested in things like density and chemical potential and pressure, et cetera. And so it turns out you actually need to coarse grain those functionals as well. It turns out you can do this in both real space by blocking, or you can do it in Fourier space like people do in Wilson style near four-dimension RG. Because we're working on a lattice, we have both of those options. So how do we do this? And I'll show you some results for this Edwards model. Turns out you need to worry about ultraviolet divergences. With these purely contact interactions, you end up with field theories that have UV or high K singularities in them. Turns out it's pretty easy to regularize that if you just replace that delta function contact interaction with a repulsive Gaussian with some width A, and we've actually moved that Gaussian from this term to over to here by a field transformation. So that basically smears the field that is the object of that diffusion equation that you're solving. That's sufficient to completely regularize the theory. So the model now has a couple of link scales. It's got this link scale associated with the range of that repulsive Gaussian interaction, but it's also got link scales relevant to the physics, namely the correlation length in the solution at the given concentration. This is a slide that shows if you, in this case, we're looking at the excess chemical potential, how these two length scales, the smoothing length and the correlation length, and that if you simulate with various lattice spacings, you've actually got to resolve this small length to get convergent results for the chemical potential. And this is true of other properties as well. So unfortunately, you need to go to very fine lattices to fully converge the theory. If you simulate with a really coarse lattice, ultimately you go larger than the correlation length. You've suppressed all the fluctuations that are important to changing the behavior of the model from mean field to non-mean field, and you basically converge to the mean field value of the property. So what do we choose for these coarse bases? Well, the simplest thing you can imagine is take the original model, keep the functional form of these objects, and just let the parameters in front float. So for a coarse Hamiltonian, we'll let this parameter float to K1 prime. We'll let C float to K2 prime. And we found that adding extra terms that are polynomials in the field can sometimes improve the fit for both the coarse Hamiltonian as well as operator renormalization. In this case, this is the operator for the chemical potential. So this basis 1, 2, 3 plus 2 parameters is what we've done most of our work with. So I'll show you quickly a couple of results. This is a result where we're doing coarse graining at fixed volume. So first you do a fine grain simulation, fully resolved. From that simulation, you do this force matching procedure, reparameterize the model on a coarser lattice, simulate that model. You can then calculate the chemical potential, doing it either real space or Fourier space coarse graining. You can then use that simulation to also reparameterize on an even coarser lattice, then simulate that model and calculate again chemical potential by either procedure. And what you see is we can keep the correct value of the chemical potential out to ridiculously large lattice spacings. And out at that level, you can just make a mean field approximation to the model because you've gone well beyond the correlation length. Another nice feature is once you start coarse graining in space, you can also drop down the contour resolution on the polymer, because after all, if you're coarse graining in space, you don't have to describe all the finer features of how the polymer threads through this very coarse structure. And it turns out you can back off on the contour resolution roughly about the 1/6 power of the grid spacing. Okay, and the final example I'll give is box expansion. This is kind of a more useful type of coarse graining. Here, we're using the same amount of resolution, same number of grid points, and we start out with a small system, high resolution, and then do one of these coarse graining cascades to take us out to a very large system with much less resolution. Okay, the black curve in both cases is the fully resolved complex Langevin simulation. So we're throwing as much resolution as we need to get the right answer. And so what you see here is a kind of typical finite size effect. Once you've gone to a box size that's about 5 times the correlation length, you get a plateau value for the chemical potential. So what this shows is if we actually start doing a simulation at this point on the finite size effect, and do coarse graining cascades using either Fourier or real space coarse graining, we can actually anticipate that finite size effect. So what's interesting is out here, we're simulating modes that weren't in the original fine grain small simulation, much longer wavelength modes, have been propagated into the theory by the coarse graining and our suitable choice of basis functionals. If you start very far down on the finite size effect curve, you obviously start making more errors. Okay? I'll skip this slide, but it's basically just saying that we get inconsistent results by refining the basis from this kind of 3+2 to including extra terms. So I want to just point to kind of future work in this area. The first is we're looking at a different formulation of polymer field theory, where the objects aren't these auxiliary fields, but are actually propagator-like objects. And it looks a little bit like the coherent state formulation of quantum field theory. So it turns out you can actually write the Edwards model with two fields that are functions of R and S along the chain. And the important thing to note about this representation is that the non-locality of the theory is completely explicit. You have an S derivative, you have a Laplacian, but it's not buried in the solution of a diffusion equation. And moreover, it's finite polynomial order in the fields. So it has a much simpler analytic structure in terms of the non-locality of the theory and also the polynomial order in the field. So we think this kind of formalism is going to be a lot more amenable to renormalization. And these are, you know, some of the applications that we're going to go after. For example, swollen mesophases and block copolymer solutions by continuous emulsions. In both cases, you're talking about structures that are fluctuating on length scales that are kind of, you know, tens to hundreds of nanometers and would take very, very large fine-grained simulations to do by brute force. So we're going to kind of coarse grain up to the just below the relevant scale of the structures and then compute. Okay, so. Okay.
Thank you this very is much.
Just summary. Okay.
So, Glenn, thank you very much for this interesting talk and for almost staying in time.
Yeah.
I'm sure there are questions, comments.
Thank you. How do you incorporate ionic groups or in ionizable polymers? You started with the SIS polymer as one of your examples.
So SIS is not an ionizable polymer, but we certainly can do polyelectrolyte models. I mean, SIS is styrene, isoprene, styrene, okay? It's not like the surfactant SIS.
Yeah.
So you go back to the particle model, and you can put discrete charges on the chains, or you can where you can smear the charge out along the backbone. The model then has Coulomb interactions in it. You need to introduce a field, an auxiliary field, to decouple those Coulomb interactions. In this case, that auxiliary field turns out to be a fluctuating electrostatic potential field. The beauty of it is it gets inverted. So one of our interaction becomes a Laplacian in the field theory, and it's very local, and you don't have to deal with Ewald sums and all that business because the complex Langevin equation for the electrostatic potential looks like a stochastic Poisson-Boltzmann equation.
Glenn, yeah. In your very first simplest example of mean field theory, you showed the picture of mixture of homopolymer and heteropolymer.
Yeah.
I didn't understand. It seems a non-equilibrium object. What does self-consistent field theory have to say about
it? Yeah. So this is not a converged saddle point. That's just a snapshot after we've run this descent algorithm for a while. We started with a random initial condition. It's a blend of a block copolymer and a homopolymer. What you can see is happening is it immediately started to phase separate, and you get droplets. The white droplets are the homopolymer, which is phase separating, macroscopic phase separation, whereas the block copolymer, as it's being purified, is microphase separating into this hexagonal mesophase morphology. So you have the coexistence between a homogeneous phase and a mesophase. Okay. Now, obviously, the lowest free energy configuration would be one big drop of white, but it would take a long time running the descent algorithm to get there. So this is actually not a metastable state. It's, you know, it.
So do you therefore believe that the numerical algorithm of going down to the cell point demonstrates intermediate structure similar to physically intermediate structure of physically developing.
It seems to generate states that look physically realistic. You could make the descent dynamics a little more realistic if, for example, you put a Laplacian in front and it was a conserved relaxation that would at least conserve mass. So we can fiddle with the, you know, with the dynamics to try to make the dynamics a little bit more like physical dynamics. But here, really, what we're trying to do is explore energy landscapes.
So Glenn, I found your complex Langevin simulations really, really interesting. I've tried these actually a bit in the context of trying to get quantum time correlation functions from path integrals. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, there I find the complex forces that you have up there just oscillate violently, and it's very hard to control the numerics. Yeah. So I'm wondering, you know, have you thought about what it is that makes it work in your problem? I mean, is it right to conclude that the sine problem is just not that severe in your field theory, or?
The sine problem is actually very severe, particularly as you go to more and more dilute solutions. The fields fluctuate more and more wildly. They fluctuate very weakly at high density because basically the trajectory just bounces around the saddle point in a kind of narrow harmonic basin. But as you dilute the system, you get much wilder fluctuations. And the sine problem is real, but I think we have an advantage here. It turns out, for example, that our Hamiltonians and forces are analytically pretty well-behaved objects. So for example, if any classical fluid model that we pose in the grand canonical ensemble, you can show that H is an analytic function of W. Okay. If you pose it in the canonical ensemble, it's got a branch point associated with that log of Q. But overall, the analytic structure of these theories is pretty simple, whereas in fermionic field theories, you have all kinds of pathologies in the complex plane. And I think that's potentially part of the problem. The other thing we've learned is you don't naively just start time-stepping these kind of equations with explicit algorithms. If you do, you will immediately get exploding trajectories. That you need really good algorithms that are very stable against pretty large excursions. And so we either use semi-implicit time stepping, where we actually, our best scheme right now is something that Mike has developed based on exponential time differencing. So you actually extract analytically the linear force, and you use that as an integrating factor over the time step.
And then you put it into an implicit scheme or something like that, like backward Euler or one of these?
Backward Euler it's a stochastic, there's stochastic ODEs and PDEs, not deterministic. So
right.
So it's a little more complicated than that.
Okay.
Further questions? Yeah, Michael.
Glenn, very, very nice presentation. I have a question. How do you deal with intramolecular correlations? Like you showed correlation lengths of the Edwards type for uncharged polymer was 1/√ of concentration, where if you include intramolecular correlation, it should probably have a slightly stronger dependence on concentration. Also with poly electrolytes, there are some intramolecular features. So on very small length scales, you don't have your parameter C very large. It's typically 1. And so how do you deal, is there a protocol of simulating something on small scales first on either particle or something else to get the correct intramolecular structure, then putting into your calculation when you get your field theory to begin to work at larger scales?
Yeah. So, you know, within the model that we've posed, the full simulation has all the physics in it, okay? But the problem is, in many problems like polyelectrolytes or as you're, chemically specific details on shorter length scales in polymers require real hardcore interactions. Shape matters, right? In the case of polyelectrolytes, we know that, you know, for example, if you have divalent ions, they're going to slam down on chains and in a very shape and charge specific way. When we put hardcore interactions in these models, it's a disaster because basically to get a convergent result, just like, you know, when we regularize these theories with this length scale A, you've got to resolve the grid below those length scales. And if you're resolving down at atomic length scales, you ought to be doing particle-based atomistic simulations that are a lot more efficient. Okay, so this really works in this kind of mesoscopic region where the physics is dominated by these length scales that are not angstrom, but are kind of 1 nanometer and up. Then you can get by with these kind of, you know, softer core potentials.
So do you have a way of merging a very small-scale atomistic type of description of either polyelectrolytes or with yours? I mean, is there a step down where you can merge
it? Yeah. Well, in principle, there is. I don't think we have it yet, but we're working on other coarse-graining strategies other than force matching that allow you to bridge different types of models, right? So.
Thank you.
Are there further questions right now? I don't see that. That means we are right on time to switch to the next talk, and we will switch gears but come back to these kind of topics later on. The next talk is given by Mark Tuckerman from NYU, and he will talk about exploring the free energy landscapes of complex molecules and crystalline polymorphs. So, Mark, please.